You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. As I said, Riyad Satouf is France's best-known graphic novelist. He was born in Paris in 1978 to two, one might say, mismatched parents. His bookish French mother and Syrian father, a pan-Arabist, met in a cafeteria at the Sorbonne. And in his graphic novel series, The Arab of the Future, and now The Arab of the Future 2, he recounts his childhood split between France and two of the most closed societies of the Arab world, Muammar Gaddafi's Libya and Hafez al-Assad's Syria. It's a baffling adult world, and the endearing protagonist, as you will see, a narrator of these two books, The Arab of the Future, is little Riyad, with, quote, flowing blonde hair like a Hollywood actress. He's the boy who never fits in. The Arab of the Future is a comic and melancholy child's eye view of an eccentric and troubled family and an incisive picture of the Arab world in the late 70s and early 80s. And it sets the stage for the revolutionary changes that will grip and roil the region decades later. And I'd just like to mention that Riyad's epic story and the kind of amazing rare window that he gives into intimate life and Arab culture will be in our minds later in October when we welcome a Libyan-British writer, Hisham Mattar, to the Aloud stage for his memoir, The Return. For over 10 years, Riyad Satouf drew a series on Parisian street life for the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. The Arab of the Future, which has been translated into 16 languages, is his first work to appear in English, which we celebrate tonight. He's now a weekly columnist for L'Obs. He also directed the film The French Kissers and Jackie in the Woman's Kingdom, which is set in the People's Republic, Democratic Republic of Bourbon, where the women are in power and fight the wars and where the men wear veils and look after the home. And in conversation with Riyad tonight is Elvis Mitchell, who's host, I'm sure as you know, of the pop culture radio show The Treatment, on our media partner KCRW 89.9 FM and film curator of year-round programming for Film Independent. He previously hosted the TCM interview program Under the Influence and was also chief film critic for Movie Line. He served as chief film critic at the New York Times and was entertainment critic for NPR's Weekend Edition and has produced the documentary The Blacklist Volume 1, which won the NAACP Image Award. Please welcome now Riyad Satouf and Elvis Mitchell. Thank you.
Hello. Oh, a pair of glasses out here. This is perfect. Now I can see. I've got to ask you, because in the books we were just talking backstage about this, there's so much about fear that are in these books, isn't it?
It's true that when I started to write The Arab of the Future, I wanted to tell the story of the point of view of a child, of me when I was a child. And it's true that when I was a child, I was afraid of a lot of things. Fear was very important. So maybe I was. I wanted to speak about the fear of children, you know, the fear of unknown, the fear of being accepted or not being accepted, the fear of discovering new places, new people, that you have to adapt to them. And it's true that I have very vivid memories of my early childhood, and I remember it was very important in my life as a child.
But also the fear of being different. I mean, that runs through this a lot, just being different from other people and what that does to you.
In The Arab of the Future, I tell the story of my family, and my father was from Syrian and from poor background, and he was the only guy in his family who was able to go to school. Then he was a very good student, and he, by the luck of life, he became a doctor in La Sorbonne. And he met my mother, and they got married. My mother was French. And he took us back to live in his village in Syria, near the city of Homs. And I was blonde at that time, had very big blonde hair, like I was very handsome and cute. Yeah, you know.
You look like a pop star.
Yeah, I was a young Brigitte Bardot, you know. Like,
I'm sorry, that's so beautiful. I'll be okay.
So everybody wanted to touch me, and women always wanted to have me on their knee and touch my hair. And it was like a dream to me, you know. And it changed after that. You know, I lose my blonde hair when I was a teen. And this book is obviously, it's like, you know, I started my life as being like an elf, you know. And when I was a teen, I became a troll, you know. And after that, I was a troll with a memory of being an elf, you know. And this is what I'm telling in the Arab future, because when everybody look at you and admire you, you have a different perception of life. And in this village near Homs, it's true that I was the only guy with blonde hair. So everybody was looking at me like I was an alien from another planet.
Well, in America, we have a blonde troll, Donald Trump, so it's kind of a combination.
Yeah.
But one of the things I was telling you that I love so much about these books is that they feel like films to me. And you mentioned that Truffaut is one of your favorite filmmakers, and it's like reading the inspiration that the 400 Blows had on you. And I really love that about these.
But it's true that I really love François Truffaut. It's one of my favorite director, and I always liked the point of view he has on youth and young people. And for example, in The Arab, the Future, in the second volume, I describe the school in Syria. It was very hard, and you know, we had uniforms, and the teacher had sticks. And they were hitting children all day in school. When you were, speaking in classroom, you would get a stick on the hand. And people always in France, sometimes it tells me, oh my God, it's awful how violent and awful society it is in Syria and blah, blah, blah. This could be true, but in France, it was like the same in the 50s. And in The 100 Blows, François Truffaut describes his school. And it's almost like the same school I had in Syria. So it was 50 years ago. So I think this is what I tried also to show in those books, is that we sometimes think that the culture are very different, but they are not so different. It's only, you know, progress and economic situation that create difference. That's my point of view, but...
But one of the things that's, because the emotions are so intense, that things change so quickly. As you mentioned, these teachers go from smiling and being kind of angelic to getting really angry all of a sudden, and their voices change, and they're hitting somebody or humiliating people.
Yeah. It's but this is the kind of situation that you have to adapt to. For example, when I was in school in Syria, I on the second day I discovered that if you don't obey to the teacher, you will be hit very hardly. So I obeyed to the teacher. And I didn't understand how children for like my 4 years of school, some of them never obeyed to the teacher. And they were hit all day. And I was thinking, are they crazy? Why don't they shut their mouth one time? And they would, no, there was always... speaking together and being hit all day, and it was, this is my teacher,
right here,
for
yes,
example.
Yes. And you were even afraid to go to the bathroom because if somebody had an accident, they would be embarrassed in front of the whole class. You said you would hold on to it all day long.
Yeah, because in the school in Syria, the school has been built without toilets. Children went to pee and what is the other word? I don't
poop.
Know. Poop. Oh, I said it in Los Angeles. Poop. in the back of the school. So, but I hated it. You know, it was impossible to. So I kept myself all day. But all the children, they were young children. You know, so it was very difficult to be, how to say that, clean. You know, when you were a young child, they were 5 years old, for example, and 6 years old on this image. So each of them wasn't really clean.
And there's a great sequence here where the teacher asks you guys to do raindrops.
Oh, yeah. You want to try?
Yes.
Because we're...
It's a bunch of... Go ahead. Tell them how to do it.
Because it was... I think it was a Soviet... because Syria was a Soviet country.
Right.
It was not a religious dictator at all. It was like a Soviet country. And Syria was an ally to the USSR. So we had the same education method than in the Soviet Union. And we had a lot of different group activities, for example. And one of the favorite group activities of our teacher, the lady we showed that, was to make us make... the rain sound, while she was eating. So she sat on her desk, she put her sandwich, and she told us, make the rain sound. And for her, we can try if you want, it's very easy, it's doing like that. You know? And stay, continue. And we were doing this, continue. We were doing this for 20 minutes, and she was eating her sandwich like... But it was an occupation, you know. When you do this, you don't want to speak to your...
But you also mentioned... That explains why you're so well-educated. But it also, she would just be obviously nostalgic. Because you mentioned that she would just sit there and eat her sesame crackers or a sandwich and just look very sad.
Yeah, I think she was depressive, can we say that? Mm-hmm. Because she was sometimes very gentle and very nice, and brutally she became like a monster hitting you with all her strength, and it was melancholic. Maybe she was an artist, I don't know. She was, but I still, I think I've drawn her very realistically. She had...
the miniskirt and the high heels.
Yeah. And this is a very strange thing, because I'm haunted by the high heels of my teachers in Syria. You know, they were wearing veils, you know, religious veils, but they had incredibly high heels with, how do we say, it was very, like a needle.
Stiletto.
Yeah, and it was like everything was, so she was little big, for little, she was big. And it was like everything was going to explode at the time, you know? Like, and I was looking at her shoes, and the needle was like, and this is an incredible vivid memory in my. And I tried to draw it in.
We just look at that and just see all the complique, all the contradictions here. She's wearing this tight sweater, that tight skirt, but the hijab.
Yeah, with a.
Yes,
so it's like that.
And that little blonde boy there is you.
Yeah, I was beautiful, no? What did you
say? Yes, you were. And you also had a beautiful book, the only book bag in the entire school, right?
Yeah, because all the children in this village were very from poor conditions. They were children from farmers and peasants, and they had no money to buy how do you say
backpacks,
yeah, so they had plastic bags like when you go shopping,
grocery shopping bags. Yeah.
And so they had no shoes, for example. Their shoes were like how can I describe it? It's like you take
the plastic shoes, yeah, imitation sneakers,
exactly,
with the, as you mentioned in the book, with the laces printed on them.
Exactly.
And there's no difference between the left shoe and the right shoe.
Exactly. It was one shoe, like you take...
it's like very Soviet, actually.
Yeah. Old Star, you put it in plastic, and you have the like a sculpture in plastic of Old Star, but with a hole where you put your finger inside. It was plastic shoes, you know.
No, but it actually sounds like very much like sort of Soviet, like the trench coats with the buttons and the belts like sculpted on them because they were plastic coats as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was like military Soviet school a little, and children were wearing uniforms. And
but you had, and your father even mentioned to you that he didn't, as a boy, he didn't even wear shoes.
Yeah.
So you had this bag that was beautiful until you realized it wasn't as beautiful as you thought it was?
Yeah. I was much more... we were richer than those
your
children.
Your father made a lot of
money. A little. So I had normal shoes and trousers that were clean. So and immediately I was different from the other kids.
What did they call you in school?
I was a Jew. Yeah, because at that time, it's always it's just still the same today. But all the children were educated in the hate of Israel, and for them it was very clear. The Cold War was very clear in their mind. It was very strange because I didn't knew nothing about that because my father was an historian, a doctor in history, and I didn't knew nothing about the Cold War, and all those children. They were from very poor origin, but it was very clear to them that they were ally with the Soviet Union. And Europe was ally with United States, and United States was Israel.
Israel, yeah.
So as a French, I was the Yahudi, the Jew. So I had to prove always, all day, that I wasn't to be accepted, you know. And when somebody at that time told you that you're a Jew, it was the worst insult you can imagine. So everybody was, they were always speaking about theory about me, you know. Like a guy, that's what I'm telling in the second volume.
Mm-hmm.
A guy was telling me, he's a Jew. And another kid came and looked at me and said, he wanted to defend me, you know, against the guy. And he told him, now listen, 5 minutes, he can't be a Jew. And the other guy said, yeah, he's a Jew. Look, his blonde hair. He's Jew. And the other guy, no, if he was a Jew, the glorious secret service of Syria would have took
executed.
Him to prison, execute him immediately. They might have files on him. So he can't be Jew and be here like that. And all the children were speaking about that all day and all day. And it was quite strange. Yeah.
Well, what's fun, too, about the book is your back and forth trips from Syria to France. And at the end of the first volume, it's completely heartbreaking when you think you're moving back.
Yeah, my story wasn't finished. Yeah, that's true. I was preferring actually France. That's true, because in France there was a lot of toy store. You know. I was really, you know, a young consumer, you know, I was obsessed with toys. In Syria, there was no toys. Children had no toys.
Well, tell them about the Israeli toys.
Yeah, unless the Israeli soldiers, plastic soldiers.
Describe those to them, because that's pretty amazing.
We don't have image of them, but it was like plastic soldiers with David Star on it, can we say that?
Star of David, yes.
Star of David on it. And the plastic soldiers had a very mean face, like they were very,
They looked evil.
Yeah, evil, exactly, evil. And for example, there was various soldier in various position, and one of the position I remember very clearly was an Israeli soldier holding a white flag, a kind of white flag, and so he was surrendering. You know, like
with one hand,
and
so one hand has a white flag,
hand, and in his other hand he had a knife
behind his back.
And all my cousins were playing and said, "Hey, I'm surrendering! Yeah, we won the war!" And one other cousin said, "No, look, he's got a knife. When you will come to make peace, he will kill you like that." So after that, it will always finish. My cousin were cutting head of the toy soldier. You know. It was that kind of toys that my cousin in Syria had. That's true. So I prefer France. It was much more. You know, it has robots and big gym and.
I'm sorry. Just because we were talking backstage and sharing our love of science fiction and fantasy. And one of your favorite comics artists happens to be one of my favorite writers and artists, Richard, as fans know, Rich Corbin.
Yeah, it's difficult to relate, I think, Rich Corbin work on my work, but it's true that when I was a teen, I was completely obsessed with his comics, the comics of Richard Corbin. I love the way he described the fear feeling and his description of paranoia and the feeling that reality sleeps and you it's like a twilight zone. I don't know. And he's a master in the narration of comics. So he was a great inspiration for me. But at that time in Syria, I didn't knew him at all. I was only reading Tintin and Milou. I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
You
sure,
know
sure.
It?
Yeah.
Is it famous in United States?
Well, we had a Tintin movie here.
Ah, yeah, Spielberg, of course.
I'm sorry, it's a really bad movie.
Sorry.
Yes, we're sorry too. It's a bad movie, but we got people to read those comics, and that would be great. But you, but even though with Rich Corbin, we're talking about this, there's a really intense atmosphere of fear that you never know what's going to happen, and what you think is one thing turns out to be something else, which happens quite frequently in the Arab of the future, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe, but it's true that when I was a child, I was a sensation that everything could happen. And obviously, things were happening like completely crazy. So somebody, for example, I had a friend who came for almost a year in school. He was very gentle, and one day he didn't came, and we didn't know what happened to him. And the teacher never told us. And maybe he died, maybe he moved, but I don't know. And it was very strange, like he disappeared completely, and the teacher was not asking for his name. And it's like when reality changes and you don't know what's happening, but things are happening without you having control on them. And I like stories like that, you know, when everything can become completely crazy and in 1 second without...
Without warning, it just happened so suddenly. Like your cousins were saying that you were famous in school because you hadn't shown up yet, and when you go to school, you were going to be beaten, and suddenly you have to be terrified of going to school for your first day of school.
Yeah. Because my father accepted that I don't go to school for the first year because he was thinking I was too young, but my cousins that they had my age, they went to school, and the teacher. He had my name on the list of the students because of, I don't know, he didn't. And each day he was calling my name, but I wasn't there. You know, I was at home. And my cousin told me that each day he was saying, Riyad Satouf, where is he? Where is this motherfucker? He's not at home. And he was always telling about me, like, so one day, if he come to school, I will beat him until he die. I swear to God, and la la. And I was at home, you know, like, and my cousin were always telling me, like, ah, he spoke about you today again. He's answering where you are, and he want to kill you, and blah blah blah. And it was like I really didn't wanted to go to school, really. Yeah.
But everything is the newness of everything to you. Every new experience is so vivid. Meeting your father's mother, who basically never really spoke to you and wouldn't really hold her head up, but you just remember her smell. And then you also compare that smell to the smell of your mother's mom, who she wore perfume, but you actually like the smell of your father's mother more. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's because I think I have memory of my childhood. It's like an animal memory. I don't know... You know, I remember sounds, I remember smells, I remember colors, and smells were very important for me, and it's still important for me today. I'm still judging people with their smell, you know.
So, how do I do?
I like you very much. It's sometimes when somebody puts too much perfume, for example, my French grandmother, I hated it because it was too strong, too... Like a part, she was hiding a part of her personality, you know, I don't know. And for example, in Syria, all my aunts had a sweat smell,
sure.
But very different from one person to another. And there was person I preferred to another to go to, and the people that were more gentle with me were the people that I prefer the smell, you know. It's strange. Oh, not so strange, but I judge people on smell, yeah.
No, it's a sense memory.
There is a Batman here. I don't...
Yes, yes. He's a superhero. Yes, he's one of the X-Men. You can tell who you are by your smell. But you describe like these kids who live down the hall from you, and the little girl, you describe her by her smell.
In which?
In the first volume. You said there's like, look, there's these two kids you played with.
Yeah.
And the little girl you said smelled bad. You remembered her smell, you remember?
You talk
about her smell.
Maybe, I don't
remember. I'll show you the book.
I don't remember my own book.
You talk about this sort of washed out crimson here that we see here.
I don't remember.
But I mean, just the way you use the colors in these.
In the book, I put myself some limitation on the use of colors, for example, because I think colors are very good to express emotion and express to limitate colors is very very strong to explain an ambience. For example, on this page, this was a neighbor. I'm describing a neighbor of my French grandmother.
It's a crazy lady.
And she was living near the house of my grandmother in Brittany, in France. And she was living in this house in the 80s. She was living without electricity and without water. And she was, and the floor of her house was soil, you know,
dirt.
And if you took her and put her with her house, like, you know, aliens, they come and took her and put her in the Middle Age, she would have lived completely normally. So it was interesting for me to show that in France at that time there was still people living in much more bad condition than it was in Syria, for example. This is why I think it's economic evolution that changed society, and it's not cultural specificity, you know.
Yeah, and how a lot of the world is really the same once you get out of the big cities.
Yeah, for me there was no difference between this lady and the... there was difference because she was much more poor again than...
Actually, her conditions were worse than people living in Syria.
Exactly.
These are the kids I was talking about.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I was forgotten this.
Yeah, you should. It's a really good book. You should read it.
Her mother was smelling animal poop. That's true.
And you said,
I liked her smell, yeah.
Yeah, you said she always smelled funny. Alban, her name?
Yeah. I like it. That's true. I completely...
And you know, the other part is good too. I mean, the other volume, you should look at both of these.
No, it's true.
I guess I want to ask you too about the writing of this. Did you, when you sat down to do them, did you know how many volumes you were going to do or how far you want to go with The Arab of the Future?
Not really. When I started the book, I told my publisher that I had a plan for 3 books.
Okay.
Because I was thinking that a trilogy could be like, you know, hip. Like Star Wars or something like that.
And to there's 30 of them, though.
To convince him to make... But I started to draw, and then I had a lot of things to tell, and I think it will be in 5 volumes, much more than 3. And also because it's in France, it's a success, so maybe we'll make 5, 6, 7, 8 volumes.
Yeah, just like Star Wars. We keep doing those, too.
The prequels, the sequel, everything.
But I just wonder about that too, because again, this, I guess I want to ask you, talk to you too, but a little bit about your drawing style, because you even offer some great information that as a boy, you had this incredible facility for drawing. I mean, you drew this picture of Pompidou that everybody recognized. How old were you when you did that drawing? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think I was 3 years old. And it's very, because I like to express, wanted to tell this story because... all my life, I heard from my family, my mother, my father, and my grandmother, that I was gifted, you know. And gifted means, you know, sometimes you see a child and you say, oh my God, he's gifted for music, he's gifted for drawing, and blah, blah, blah. And I think it doesn't exist. For example, I remember perfectly what started all my, how do you say, career of cartoonist is... one day I was making a drawing like that, but I didn't know what I was drawing, you know. My grandmother came, she looked at my drawing, and she thought it was like a French president. His name was Pompidou.
Pompidou, yeah, sure.
So she looked at my drawing and said, "Oh my God, you have drawn Pompidou." And I watched her face. I remember perfectly. And she was like looking at me like I was much more. I was a genius, Brigitte Bardot, you know. I was not only beautiful. I was like, and she took my drawing and go and showed it to my father. And she told him, "Look, he draws Pompidou." And my father, he was an historian. And presidents were very important for him. So he looked at my drawing and said, "My God, this is Pompidou." And he called me and he said, "What did you draw?" And I heard this word, you know, Pompidou, 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 for the word. And I said, "Pompidou." And this, so everything started. And then I've drawn Pompidou for 3 years. That's what I'm telling you. That each time I wanted to, I said, "Look, I draw Pompidou, Pompidou." And I was a genius who was able. And I think, you know, this kind of situation can... reading the admiration and the love in the eyes of your parents is what you seek when you do things like that. And I'm still doing the same today. You know, I'm drawing Pompidou to impress people. I think it's a very... It's just the way you look to children that can decide what they do after, you know.
So even as a 3-year-old, you were a political cartoonist.
Yeah.
Because I guess I wonder about that too. In that first volume, you start, there's a boy who sits next to you who just scribbles, and you start imitating him. You actually feel better about yourself when you're doing that, don't you?
Yeah, but it was, I told this in the book, that when I was in very small school in France for some months, I was the best drawer at that time, because I was drawing, you know, what's the name in English? Santa Claus? No.
Yeah, Santa Claus.
Santa Claus with the face of Pompidou.
Pompidou, yes.
And the teacher.
That's very political, by the way. Santa Claus and Pompidou.
And but the other children were not impressed about my drawings. You know, they were always drawing me like things like that.
Yeah, there were kids who drew.
And I realized that it was much more cool to draw like them. So I stopped drawing Pompidou and I started to draw like them, and I was accepted in the group. So that's true. For some couple of months, I stopped drawing to be like the other
kids. I have to say, because having read some things about you, including the New Yorker profile, I expect you to be a much more serious guy. You know, New Yorker piece makes you sound like you're incapable of smiling. The New Yorker profile, if you had a chance
to
read
it. No, I'm a funny guy.
Yes, you're a great guy. You're very easy to... I read that piece and I thought, I have no idea what to ask this guy, for God's sake.
No, you know, because we can't speak about that, but 2 years ago, you know, my book goes out, and at that time, my publisher called me and told me, "Oh my God, something incredible is happening to you. The New Yorker want to make a profile of you." You know, if it was like God came on earth and said, "You, I will change your destiny." So I had to, you know, to tell everything to... So a journalist came in Paris, and it was like I had to tell him everything. And he wanted to know the rest of the story. He wanted... And I was telling him, "No, I don't want to tell the rest of the story. I want to tell it in the book." And he said, "Okay, there will be no profile on you." No. Like, you know... It was very... So after that, he was always meeting people, and all the people he was meeting were telling him that they loved the book. And it was a problem for him, because he wanted to find people who hated it.
Really?
Yeah, really. So he started to phone everybody. You know, he called all the Arab of Paris to know them. So he was seeing me. I was watching him, and he was saying, "Yesterday, I had an interesting lunch with Mohammed Abdel Qatar, who was an ambassador for the Palestinian Authority during the 80s, and he read your book." And I was like, "Yeah, what he said? You know, I haven't any idea that those people were reading my book." And he said, "He liked it." So he found...
Well, that's awful. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was not very... So I didn't want to speak, to say anything. And so he found a guy who is completely crazy and who hated my book. And he put it in the, I don't know, it's, so I'm happy, you know, the profile goes out and everybody told me, oh my God, you have a profile in the New Yorker, so wonderful for you. But you know, but I'm gentle, you know, but I just don't want to tell the rest of the story.
So that's what it was, because I thought you were going to get in a fight with this guy.
Yeah, a little.
Yeah, but I, because, of course, too, in that kind of situation, he's going to ask you about Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, because looking at your illustration style here, and again, going from the cool blues and that sort of distance of this sort of washed out pink of Syria, talk about why you use this color for your father's country.
But when I started to go back in my memory to... memory of Libya, of Syria, and Brittany and France, I discovered that each country had a different ambience. You know, Libya, there was a lot of sun,
so
there was
golden,
sand,
sure.
And now it's yellow, so I decided to put it yellow. Syria, the soil was red.
Ah.
I have this in my mind. I don't know if... So I decided to put it like pink. Like, you know, pink ambience. And France, it was blue because of the sea, because of Brittany. So colors separated each country with a unique color to provoke, I don't know the English name, in French is dépaysement.
Oh.
I don't know if there is French people who know this. It's like when, dislocation maybe?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like when you read a story, is yellow, 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 and bam, it becomes blue. Like you change the word, you will not find the yellow again. It's, you have to adapt to the blue. It's like you...
You want to go back to see my eyes playing tricks on me? But for me, this is what you use to, I think, to communicate that emotional intensity. Because we see that yellow of Libya very early on. I mean, it's like, it's really powerful. And then to go to that kind of cold blue... of France. I mean, that actually makes a place seem literally cold.
Mm.
And there's something kind of almost sentimental, even though Syria is completely terrifying to you as a boy. There's something kind of, we can see your feelings about that place too, because there's so many relatives you had there who you were fond of, because they are who they are. You know exactly who you are, who they are when you, everybody's always telling you that maybe they want to start a fight, or get to know you, but all these worlds are very intense for you, and I feel like those color changes are about communicating that intensity.
Yeah, it's true. For example, when you, if you stay 1 hour or 2 hour in a room that is lit in red, and you go outside, the world will appear to you green. It's a biological. It's in the eyes. It's like that. If you stay in a place blue, you go outside, outside will become orange, for example. And this is the power of color on the eyes, but it's biological. And I tried to put this in my comics. Because it's like an hypnosis, like pink, 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 like you want to puke at the time. It's pink. Oh. For example, my mother, when she read the I speak about her in the volume, but when she read the part in Syria, she told me, why did you put pink in Syria? Because pink is a positive color for her, because she's very girly, you know, she has pink dress and things like that. And she, for her, it's a positive color, and for her, those years in Syria are very sad. So, but for me, it was like that. So I like this, to use a positive color to put it on dark situation.
There's something else you do, too, in that you'll have a drawing, like we see down in the lower left hand, there'll be a description of somebody. You see down that panel all the way at the bottom on the left. Inside the panel, while there's a descriptive balloon on the top, there'll be like a description in cursive at the bottom. And I wonder how you arrived at that. You see here, you would do this description.
Oh yeah, a small description.
Yeah,
I like doing this. It's to explain to the reader Maybe you can put the C, 107C, I think. To describe a small detail.
Sure.
It's a very, yeah. This is A, B. Yeah. This one.
That's
perfect.
Right, yeah. That's it.
And your chair fixed with nails, for example. This guy was driving a bus, and his seat was a chair, and tac tac tac. It was like in a Mad Max movie, you know. It was quite post-apocalyptic science fiction, you know. And if I didn't write chair fixed with nails, I think the reader would not see it, you know. So this was important for me to.
Because what that does, because obviously you're capable of doing fine art if you want. You can just tell from the illustration of Gaddafi or Assad that you do here. Just having that footnote, as we would call it here, really makes us, it does something, and it also sort of makes this feel really intimate. It's almost like this comes out of your diary or your notebook,
yeah.
That kind of detail. And I wonder when you decided to start doing that. Was that early on?
Yeah, it was quite early, because it's a system I used a lot in my other comic books.
Yeah, but there it was almost like a way to comment on something. And here it actually makes it much more intimate.
Yeah, maybe. It's good to describe. There is another comic book artist who, I think, maybe he's the one who invented that. It's Robert Crumb. He used it a lot, you know.
Okay, we're friends now. Robert Crumb and Richard. Chris Ware and Rich Corbin. But yes, you're a big Corbin. You're a big Crumb fan, too.
I like him a lot, yeah, of course. It's true that he used a lot of those kind of, you know, to criticize and say stupid face or big...
Yeah. And it's funny, too, because one of the things that, well, at least Corbin and Crumb have in common is the way they draw women.
Yeah, and I don't draw women too much for me. Yeah, it's true.
But those guys, I mean, because I wanted to digress, all this whole conversation's been a digression, to talk about your movie, which is, how many people here have seen this movie?
Nobody.
You've got to see this film.
Download it illegally.
It's
on.
It's really,
you can
funny.
Download it. It's very easy.
Yeah, can you download it?
Yeah,
okay.
It's illegally. You can have it.
I'm not hearing any of this. The illegal stuff. Do what you will. But the American title is French Kisses, and it could be from a future volume of Arab of the Future. It's about a teenage boy in Brittany who meets the girl of his dreams, and you get very close. We see noses, we see pimples, and that could be almost a Crumb illustration, in fact, the way you cast some of those boys, but also the way you use women, because I was telling you, I really love the fact that the French actress Irene Jacob, who was in The Double Life of Veronique, her character's name in the film, in your movie, is?
Veronique, yeah, also. It's... I made this movie 8 years ago, and...
What made you think you wanted to make a movie at that point?
It's because the producer of the movie, she was a great woman, and she liked my comics.
Okay.
But other comics I've done before, The Arab of the Future, and she... It was comics on teenagers. She liked them, and she told me, do you want to make a movie? And I said, yes. Let's try. It's like if tomorrow NASA come to me and say, do you want to go to space with your back problem and your... And I say, yes. You're like, you know, you have the chance. You have only one life. So I said, yes. So I wrote the script and I directed the movie. And it was a huge success in France. Yeah, truly. It was a story about a sex-obsessed teenager. Not very original subject, you know,
But it's something that maybe some of us can relate to. You know, maybe we went through this kind of thing in high school. But you have, in addition to Irene Jacob, you also have another actress that we both like in this film.
Valeria Golino.
Yes.
She's an Italian actress. Yeah, wonderful actress.
Who you saw in the movie.
Yeah, because when I had to choose the actors for my movie, it was always with affective and emotional choices, for example. You know, it was a completely outsider movie, so there was no stars in it, for example. My main character was a true 14-year-old boy who was truly obsessed with women, truly masturbating all day in his real life.
And he was in the movie, by the way, too.
Yeah, he was the main character. So I had no. So when I had to choose the adult actors, I chose them about my what they meant to me when I was young, you know. And Valeria Golino, I don't know if you've seen this movie. Maybe she's famous in the United States because she played in Rain Man, for example.
Sure, but what was the movie you saw her in?
Yeah, and in the Hot Shots.
Yes, we've seen that movie in America, Hot Shots. That's a little art movie,
and
but yes.
Yeah, it was the first movie I had the right to go to see in cinema when I was young. It was Hot Shots.
And so that was your first movie in theater?
My first movie
Hot
in
Shots.
Cinema, in theater, yeah. Yeah, I'm not from a very high cultural level.
Hey, I've seen it too, so that explains a lot about me, I think, as well. But it's you got these women who are very important in your emotional life, Erin Jacob and Valeria Golino. So that's pretty wonderful.
Yeah, and they accepted to play in my movie, so I was very happy to meet them and to, I don't know. So it was a very nice experience.
Now, I was asking before if you feel like there's a movie in the Arab of the future, if you thought you were going to make a film out of these at some point.
Some people ask me that sometimes. It's true that it's the Arab of the future is a success, and I had a lot of proposition, and I had a proposition from American producer to make a movie about it also. But I refused for now because I want to finish the story, the books before
you do that.
Before I think about that.
Because you have to try to decide if you just want to. You were saying before, it's going to cover so much material, but just these two books cover so much material.
Yeah, maybe like to make like Harry Potter movie, you know. One movie by the Arab of the future. No, like, yeah.
It sounds very George Lucas when you put it that way. If we have questions here in the audience here, I guess we can, is the microphone coming down? Because I guess I want to ask you too about where your illustration style came from, because it's very direct and simple, but very powerful. I mean, the difference between your father and your mother here, because this is what we have to talk about. But who are your inspirations in terms of choosing the style of illustration that you did?
It's difficult to say I have a precise inspiration.
I'm sure there are a few of them, aren't there?
Yeah, there are a few of them. It's true that, for example, for the Arab of the future, I wanted to find the simplicity and of very simple drawings and very expressive drawings. So I avoid making too much details. I avoid making drawings too beautiful. I don't know what to. I like simple and small drawings. Like I'm not comparing to him because he's a genius. But like Chris Ware, for example, he's a very great drawer, and his drawings are very.
Simple.
Like a logo, you know.
Yeah. Green.
And I like this very much.
But almost so, in a way too, like almost cartooning, but very expressive. I mean, that's the great thing too. The difference between cultures is that in Brittany, everybody talks of, you talk about how expressive the faces are. But when you're in Syria or Libya, you don't mention that at all. The faces aren't very expressive.
Yeah, people were hiding their expression in public. All the men had mustache, for example. It was funny. Yeah.
Except for your dad.
Yeah, he had no right to have mustache by my mother. So he was very complexed with that. Each time we were coming in France with my mother and he was staying in Syria, when he came back to France, he had a mustache. And my mother was saying, no, mustache, go. And he was, all the important men have mustache. I have to have mustache also. So.
Yeah, we saw that.
I'm quite afraid about men with mustache. Do we have here? Not so much.
You have a mustache.
No, I have a beard. Yeah.
But the mustache is part
mustache
of it.
Mustache is only, you know, only mustache.
Oh, just a mustache.
Just a mustache, yeah. Like Tom Selleck, you know.
Yeah, he's very scary.
Tom Selleck, Saddam Hussein, they are together.
I made my political joke for the night. I'm not touching that one. Yes, where's the question? We have one down here in front.
Not a question, it is a comment. I feel very sorry for your bad experience in childhood. I am from Middle East also, but I am from the capital, not from a village. If they take me to a village in my country, I will feel the same like you feel. It's different world.
You from where?
I am from Baghdad.
Yeah. Ah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. We have something similar. My dad is a dentist, graduated from Sorbonne in 1935. And maybe he's one of the very few dentists in Iraq at that time, because at that time there was no dental school. So he get his degree from Sorbonne. But my childhood, I am the age of your mother. My childhood is different from you. I live a very happy elementary school. It was forbidden even to beat us by ruler. Forbidden.
How lucky you are.
And and also, we have one class every day to study English. And I finished elementary school, in high school also the same, and in my college, I entered the medical school. We studied in English for 6 years, and that's where I learned English. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Wow. It's true, life was very different. For example, in the third volume of The Arab, the Future, I tell one trip I can't speak about it because it's going out next week in France. So,
but not here, so you can tell
here,
us here, because you can give us a preview.
And we have made a trip in Damas, for example, and it was like a real modern city. And it's true that in the village were, how to say, forgotten a little, you know.
Your mother must have been a very great woman, she can stand to live there.
Yeah, that's true.
She's there. There is a great difference between
yeah.
culture.
Yeah,
and that is true.
Question here, yes.
Hi, I'm actually Breton as well, and I was wondering what was your impression of the U.S. Is it your first time, and what was your impression of the U.S.?
Yes, how old were you the first time you came here, actually?
No, I came several times here. It's my first time in Los Angeles.
But how? Yeah, I was wondering, your first time. How old were you the first time you came to America?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I was 20 years old.
Okay.
I've been in New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles. I like United States really. all my friends hate me when I say that because. Of course, in France, a lot. It's, for example, 2 weeks ago, the equivalent of National Geographic in France, called Géo, asked me for an article, a page of a wonderful place where I've been, and to describe a place that I loved in my travel because I traveled a lot, and I said that one of the most beautiful place I've seen, most powerful place I've seen, was San Francisco. I loved it so much because of the hills, you know, with the street like that. You know, in France, when you have a hill like that, we will do a road that goes like that for hours and you are in this car. And the United States, straightforward, you know, you invent, engines, a big motor engine that can go out. And in France, it's not the same way of thinking, you know. So I said I love San Francisco and the place and the people. And she told me that in 10 years of asking celebrities, not really celebrities, but people, the place, the beautiful thing, I was the first guy to say something about the United States. It's like forbidden to love the United States, you know. Really, it's wow. And it's funny you ask the question because I'm very proud to say I love United. You know, when I in New York, you know, when people speak, I love the way they speak. I don't know. It's you know, I was in Berkeley and there was a homeless man. He was sitting on the street and he said to me, "Hey, you," and I looked at him, "Hey, go fuck yourself." It was like I'm in the movie, you know. So he really told me, go fuck myself. Like, I, you know, I know it's sad, it's scary, but it's very mythological place for me. I'm sorry.
No, that's because
I won't criticize. Of course, you know, I can't say bad things on the United States foreign policy and everything. And it's true that the United States abandoned Syria, for example. But I cannot, you know, I like the invention of, I like author, American author, comic book artist.
Rich Corbin and, yeah. And Harold Crumb, for goodness sakes.
You know, I like.
But you thought that was a, like a movie because your first movie was Hot Shot, so you don't know any better. Yeah, there's another question here. Yeah.
Hi. I have actually two questions. So the first one is you talk about, I think it's your cousins who you call the two nicest boys in the world, something like that. Les deux gentils garçons. Anyway, what's happened with them given all that's occurred in Syria with the war? Do you keep in touch with these people?
I will tell the rest of the story in the rest of the volume.
Okay, I won't ask.
I will tell the story, but they became, it's very, I think it would, they are still alive today.
Okay. And the other one is, in the second volume, there's a situation where you go to homes with your father, and he buys your mother all of these electronic devices, TV and whatnot. But your mother's life, she seemed always so sad. Was she ever able to reconcile? And how did she reconcile, actually, her life in Syria and her, you know, being deprived of these the possessions, the things that she looked forward to?
No, at that time, I think according to the level of education of my father, we should have lived in Damascus or at least Aleppo or at least in Homs. But it was completely strange to live in the village of my father where he grew up, because my father wanted to be, he wanted to be recognized as from his friends when he was young as a great man, you know. He was so he took us there, and my mother was never able to be happy in that place. She never learned Arabic, and she was waiting my father to make his first $1 million, you know. Like, it was, my father was convinced it could happen, but we were in a village where there was nothing, you know. And he was
a village where the houses, they locked from the outside, not
from
the inside.
Yeah, it was strange, but she was waiting him for becoming somebody. It was like that.
Do you hear from any of your relatives in Syria?
Yeah.
Have they been able to see?
Yeah, I will keep this information secret for the rest of my volume.
So, how do you like America? I have a few questions you're going to answer. Question up here, yes.
I was wondering how Charlie Hebdo is functioning these days.
I don't have contact with Charlie Hebdo because I left Charlie Hebdo 7 months before the attack. My position in Charlie Hebdo was particular because Charlie Hebdo was a magazine. Every cartoonist in France has a story with Charlie Hebdo. It was a magazine with a legendary cartoonist that they died in the attack. For example, Cabu, he was each French cartoonist, he was a legend for cartoonists because when we were children, he was giving a drawing lesson on French national TV. So every children were drawing with him and learned with him. So 10 years ago, Charlie Hebdo proposed me to join them, and I told them that I wasn't able to draw political drawing because I don't know how to draw presidents and things like that. You know, they always make joke, you know, like Barack Obama is playing golf and there is somebody saying, hey, let's save the world. And he said, it's a kind of humor. It's not making me laugh too much. But they insisted, and then I've made for Charlie Hebdo a comic book page called The Secret Life of Jung.
Teens.
And it was a transcription in comics of scenes I've seen in the street. For example, two teenagers were having fight and were speaking about subjects, and I retranscripted their description. So I've made this for 7 years, and when 7 years, I become completely depressed of telling those stories because it was awful stories every time. So I left the newspaper at that time. But for example, I never been in Charlie Hebdo. I was sending my page by email. I wasn't in the redaction speaking with.
So you were in the offices.
No.
Now, did you do your drawings electronically now? Do you still do anything with pen and ink and paper?
Yeah, I draw with pen and ink. I use a computer and a tablet, but it's all.
It's all pen and ink.
Yeah, it's by hand.
Oh, by hand. Great. That's great to hear because it's.
There's not a computer doing it for me. Huh?
No, I just know if you were drawing with a light box or anything like that. It's all.
No, not there. No.
Okay. Another question. Two more questions.
Yeah, I was wondering. You mentioned as a child, you were called a Jew, and it was a big insult. And I was just curious, when was the first time you actually met a Jewish person? And
this is just actually, I have this scene wonderful when the first time I met a Jew, and I will tell it in my book. I won't tell it to you. You will have to read the rest of my story. I'm sorry, I'm.
No problem at all. We know you so well now. Does anybody else have a question? Else have a question he can't answer before the evening is over? Any more questions?
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Okay, we have one right here. Make it good now. Ask him about the weather. He can answer that.
Sorry. When you were drawing with pen and ink, did you use just a... I'm so sorry.
Did I use what? What do you want to say? Yes. I don't know. I don't understand you.
Yes, but are you put pressure on her? Please. Let me help you.
What are you saying? speak. I'm waiting for you.
I'm sorry.
Time pass.
Would you use before? Would you sketch with pencil and then go over with pen or ink?
Yeah, you just drawing. You a pencil drawing, and then you ink it. Like Crumb would do?
Yeah. Okay. Very classical way. You know, I draw with, how is the name in English? Is a pen that you can erase with an eraser.
Yeah.
And after that, I have, you know, I hope you will be allowed to sign my book after that, huh? Because I have my pen. I can show it to you. What I did with it?
Oh, where's your pen?
Oh, I don't know. I have a pen, you know, a pencil pen. It's a classic pencil pen, and I...
Like a mechanical pencil?
I have it.
So oh, I believe you.
It's here.
It's one of the few things we can
this
actually see.
This is a technical
see.
Question. I want to answer it.
Yes, hurry up. We don't have much time here. Somebody just said recently.
Don't stress me. I'm the author. No, it's like that. You know?
And on that note, since there's nothing left to ask him, let's please thank Riyad Tahir.
Thank you very much.
And now you can sign these books for me.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.